I've called my talk tonight, A New Direction. The world's a marvellous place, whether we talk of nature or the works of man. There's so much richness and diversity that it's easy to get lost in the overwhelming amount of ever fascinating detail. Much, if not most, of what we see around us is the creation of man's busy and industrious mind. Buildings, towns and cities, roads, bridges, fields, vehicles of all description, not to mention the rich worlds of art and literature, science and commerce. All of these and much, much more have come into being because men and women first thought them into existence. This wealth of creativity and technology is alluring in the extreme. So much is this the case that we sometimes take these riches as a measure of all things and assume that the only improvements we can make to our lives are to build or create more efficient or beautiful versions of the same things. Many of us wish also to conserve the wonders of the past, to ensure that we never lose any of these marvellous human creations. But a human being is so much more than this. Every one of us has a rich inner life just waiting to be brought into focus. An inner life that is fulfilling, exciting, and radically different from the life we lead in the world we create externally. But how do we gain access to this mysterious inner territory? How do we begin to actualize the huge potential of which we are but dimly aware? The answer is simple. We turn our attention inward. We turn our attention inward to experience what is immediate and personal, to things that, generally, we do not see when caught up in the stimulating interaction with the external events we think of as normality. Though the task is in one sense straightforward, everyone runs into obstacles which, to start with, can seem insuperable. Each of us acts and reacts from a basis of different behavioural biases or temperaments. There are six main temperaments, with combinations of them making 14 in all. The basic six are craving, hatred and confusion, faith, intelligence and speculation. For the purposes of dealing with the meditator's progress, and because of similarities in behaviour between the different types, these six can be reduced to three: craving, hatred and confusion. Knowledge of the temperaments can be helpful because they indicate strongly how each of us is likely to react when faced with the task of changing his or her underlying habits of paying attention. For instance, the walker in craving, as Arahantu Patissa, who wrote Vimuttimagga, puts it, the walker in craving is greatly attracted to all things easeful and beautiful. He or she tends to cling to comfort, personal welfare and relationships, and is unhappy when things are not to her liking. She is happy to have rules, but expects to be able to circumvent them if the need arises, and may do so on a regular basis. When she performs good actions, she finds that strong faith arises, which makes following the path easier and more rewarding. The walker in craving has to work hard at the meditation. It often seems that the amount of sustained effort involved is impossibly great. Contrast that with the walker in hatred. Usually, he has little time for his surroundings, including people, and is greatly concerned to get rid of any perceived obstacle to his quest. This can mean that he is harsh with himself and others, and that he rarely allows himself to relax. He's often unduly concerned about even the smallest slip from what he considers perfect behaviour. He expects to get it right all the time. When the walker in hatred performs good actions, intelligence arises. This mental quality sees and understands what truly leads towards the end of suffering and helps greatly to overcome inefficient actions based in wrong view. The walker in hatred has to learn to take it easy. He has to realize that sheer force and destruction of obstacles is not the way to succeed on the path. Then we have the walker in confusion. He or she is someone with dullness of faculties that leads to an inability to choose right from wrong. As such, he is likely to follow the opinions of others while having none of his own. If he does try to work things out by himself, he becomes full of doubt and so becomes very distressed. His best plan is to follow instructions faithfully and to choose companions who have demonstrated their adherence to an ethically sound way of life. When the walker in confusion performs good actions, he develops the mental quality of speculation. He is able to extrapolate intellectually from a few given ideas, and this has the advantage that it's possible to see more sides of a given question. The walker in confusion needs to maximize his chances by staying around noble ones, teachers and experienced meditators, while making sure that he's impeccable in his duties. To turn inwards, our task is to quieten the mind sufficiently that it could pay sustained attention to things and processes we normally ignore, being too caught up in the worldly life that is a whirlwind of sensual indulgence and external stimulation. But it's not easy simply to switch the direction of our attention so radically. We are deeply conditioned to pay attention to external things, and our habits in this respect are strong and often seem intractable. We have to approach the changeover from outer to inner attention in graduated steps, incrementally. That way we have a real chance of changing our perceptions of this life and to discover for ourselves what lies beyond the barriers to inner seeing. If we do this in the right way, it's a truly revolutionary experience that changes forever the way we see the world. As far as the teaching of the Buddha is concerned, the very first step is to go for refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. The Buddha was a remarkable man, not a god. He sought and found an answer to the suffering that plagues mankind, and then spent 45 years teaching others how to reach the same freedom. His teaching, the Dhamma, is what we study and practice today, and it provides a sure path through the perils of this world to the mysteries of the inner life and to the far shore of the ending of suffering. We also take refuge in the Sangha. At its widest, this consists of everyone who is attempting to practice the way. At the intermediate level, it refers to ordained monks and nuns and all those who devote themselves full time to the teaching. The surest refuge, though, is the Arya, or noble Sangha, the body of men and women who have attained one of the four paths or fruitions that take them beyond the man in the street. These people are either enlightened or destined for enlightenment, and know about the path and the goal from their own experience, as well as from books. Taking refuge means exactly what it says. We can rely on these refuges as a safe haven in a troubled world. We can depend upon them for our welfare and safety. The next graduated step is to ensure that our actions are harmless to others. This serves to prevent the arising of guilt and also builds self-confidence. This settles the mind and makes it comfortable with itself. Such behaviour is codified in the five precepts, which all who take up the practice of meditation are enjoined to undertake. There are, of course, many who come to the teaching already do live in conformity with all or most of them. We then come to a series of steps that specifically address our own welfare and mental harmony rather than that of others. If we are to develop a trained mind capable of uncovering inner secrets, we need to do more than simply avoid upsetting other beings. The first of these personal steps is to develop moderation in eating. The different temperaments influence the outcome. The walker in craving is likely to find moderation in eating difficult, especially without external discipline. Given a tendency to indulge, they can forgive themselves many small slips, which more or less ensures that food remains a preoccupation. The walker in hatred takes a very different stance. If moderation is required, he will overdo it, tend towards asceticism, and deny himself even necessary amounts of food. Such individuals start to waste away and have to be ordered to eat more for their own well-being. This is perhaps the place to emphasize that the Buddha's teaching is a middle way, a way between all extremes. In this case, a middle way between the extremes of eating too much and eating too little. The next step is to tackle our dissipation through the senses. As we become more aware, it's astonishing to find just how scattered the mind is. It is constantly darting here and there to this or that sense or object and never seems to rest anywhere for more than an instant. To bring some order and focus to our attention, we need to restrain this constant outward turning. Necessarily, this is difficult at first. The mind is conditioned to flit about with virtually no control. Any attempt to halt this process feels unnatural. Sense restraint's easy to describe, but initially very difficult to do. In fact, it's simply a question of keeping the mind on what we are doing and not allowing it to stray. If it does, we simply return the attention to the task in hand, repeatedly. When we make constant attempts to keep the mind from straying everywhere, we begin to notice a startling difference. The mind becomes sharper and keener. Memory improves. We feel much more in touch with our lives and everything we do. We are happier. We notice so much more than before because we are less often caught up in thinking or daydreaming. Sense restraint on its own, however, is not enough to provide the necessary quality of attention to gain access to the inner world. We need to divorce ourselves further from the siren song of the outside world. To do this, we need a much finer focus in the form of concentration. Here, we make as little physical and mental movement as possible and deliberately hold the attention on one object or process, constantly bringing the mind back if it should wander. At the same time, outside of the formal meditation, we practice the setting up of mindfulness, which, as its name suggests, is learning to keep the mind fully on what is happening in the present moment. In this case, it's not so much a question of holding the mind on one object, but rather of making sure that it doesn't stray from whatever we are doing at the time. It is something we can practice throughout all our waking hours. We can practice the setting up of mindfulness while walking along, walking up and down stairs, changing postures, eating, or performing any of the other manifold activities that we engage in during the normal day. Mindfulness comes to full development within the seated meditation, when it keeps us fully alert and focused on what is happening. At first, setting up concentration is a great challenge, and the development of mindfulness almost as difficult. For the untrained mind delights in diversity and change so very much. Eventually, though, mindfulness is established. The mind does settle down onto the object we've chosen, whether focusing on the breathing process at the abdomen or nose tip, a mantra, one of the kasinas, or anything else, and concentration arises together with clear attention. So concentrated and mindful can the mind become that while remaining fully conscious, it can turn away from sensory activity altogether and enter what are known as the fixed meditations, jhana. These states of consciousness are said to be fixed in that they are unshakable because so far removed from the hindrances and the allure of the senses. They are the gateway to a world of experience that is very different from that which we are used to. When the focus of attention is removed from the gross physical body and its senses, we find deep states of inner calm and clarity. We are now able to use our mental focus to much greater effect than previously, when we were caught up in the concerns of the workaday world. Indeed, a meditator who has become fully skilled in the exercise of concentration could now develop what we call the six higher knowledges. He would discover that each of us has a mental body in addition to the physical. The mental body is a little like the one we use in dreams, but in this case we are fully conscious in it and potentially have full control over our actions and appearance, depending on the depth of concentration and the direction and strength of our intentions. For instance, with consciousness established in the mental body, a meditator can pass through walls, walk on water, fly through the air or space, make multiple copies of himself, become invisible, change his appearance, and many other things besides. These mental skills are due to impeccable mental control and provide fascinating and useful experiences. One of the many things that become possible is to travel to individuals to whom the meditator practices loving kindness. Through intense focus on hearing, he can hear extremely subtle sounds, things in the body, like, for example, the noise of blood rushing through arteries, and things outside the body, like sounds at a great distance, or even sounds in the heavenly realm. With the appropriate intentions and work, the meditator can know directly the minds of other beings. He can apprehend their mental states with great accuracy and know for himself if someone's mind is hindered or free, happy or sad. He can also develop his inner eye, the so-called divine eye, and literally see beings of any kind vanishing from this life and appearing in another, according to the deeds they have done. He can see for himself that those who followed unwise and unprofitable courses of action in body, speech and mind appear after death in painful states of existence. He can see too those who have followed wise ways, who hold right views, appearing after death in favorable circumstances in this world and in the heaven realm. With repeated intentions and much memory work, the meditator can remember many of his former existences, whom he was, what kind of life he led, how he died, where he was reborn, again and again. Like the divine eye, this higher knowledge brings home the facts of kamma and vipaka, action and result. These meditative skills cover the first five of the higher knowledges and depend upon exquisite control of the ability to concentrate. The experiences seem more vivid and somehow more real than those of the everyday world, but even so, they're still within the realm of the mundane. Sometimes referred to as mundane insight, these abilities give a deep and compassionate understanding of ordinary life. They emphasize, as perhaps nothing else could, the benefits of restraint and of living by an ethical code, and the perils in not doing so. The sixth higher knowledge is in a class of its own. It is supramundane, it goes beyond the mundane, and is known as the destruction of the kankas. It leads to the further shore, which is the end of ignorance, craving and hatred, the cessation of suffering, the goal of the Buddha's path to freedom. While a fully rounded meditative development would include everything mentioned so far, it's worth remembering that it can take a long time in reclusive conditions to attain the necessary skill and concentration, even if you have the potential. Further, the development of the first five higher knowledges is not actually necessary for enlightenment. We can tackle the destruction of the kankas directly. This is the so-called dry insight method. There is no immersion in concentrated states and is developed through the practice of vipassana, insight meditation. There were many people in the Buddha's day that became enlightened using just this without the benefits that knowledge of the birth and death of beings, for instance, could have brought. The Buddha advised those that became enlightened using the dry insight path subsequently to practice concentration and calming meditations for ease of living here and now. Once the destruction of the kankas is complete, it makes sense then to develop mundane peace to complement the transcendental peace and freedom already attained. Vipassana is essentially the practice of observing the coming into and passing out of existence of everything in the worlds of mind and body. We need a solid foundation of right behavior, right mindfulness, and right concentration to do it. We also need to know what we should and should not pay attention to. This means that we need to learn about the ultimates of experience, those elements of mental and physical experience that cannot be broken down any further. For instance, the three feelings. While in the West we speak of many different kinds of feeling, there are in fact only three basic kinds: pleasant, painful, and neutral. What we usually think of as a feeling before we learn to discriminate mental events is more properly a complex consisting of feeling together with a mental action, such as love or anger. For the purposes of vipassana meditation, these elemental experiences are grouped into four categories: body, feelings, states of mind, and content of mind, the four foundations of mindfulness. And a full description of the practice can be found in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is number 10 in Middle Length Sayings, volume 1. Using our developed capacity to concentrate and pay attention, we examine the members of these four groups or foundations, paying particular attention to their arising when they did not exist the moment before, and to their passing away when, having existed briefly, they disappear forever. We come to see that all things arise dependent on conditions. They do not just appear out of the blue. This being the case, we have no immediate control over what is happening. In fact, intense observation proves that I have very little to do with what goes on in mind and body. The whole thing goes on without me. It's all non-self, even the observation process itself. Pursuing the path of mindful inquiry, we examine all compounded things in the light of the three marks of transience, unsatisfactoriness, and non-self. In the process, insights arise that gradually break the stranglehold our wrong perceptions have had on our lives. No matter what we observe, we find it's transient. Nothing lasts, and that is a very unsatisfactory state of affairs, for we can never find lasting happiness in a world where every single component, part, and process is so fleeting and unreliable. Happiness and freedom must lie elsewhere. Of course, in the world there is happiness and great joy from time to time. We all know that, but these things are unreliable and unsatisfactory in that we cannot get them to last, based as they are on utterly transient conditions. This awareness keeps us faring on, walking the path, no matter how tiresome the meditation may occasionally become. By this time, we've come too far and know too much to give up. So we learn to face our inner demons and have compassion for them. We overcome our inner fears through refusing to run away, as we have so often done before. In time, with continued practice, the meditation settles down and we see things never seen before. From much correct observation of body, feelings, states of mind and content of mind, insights arise. Sometimes they seem a long time coming, but if the practice is done correctly, arise they must. We see deeply the insanity of attachment, grasping and clinging, the true dukkha of the world, and what's more, in none of this can we find a self. We realize that our entire outlook has been faulty for years, decades, even lifetimes. With sufficient meditative work, the meditator passes through all the 17 stages of insight to arrive at the fruition of the first path and glimpse for the first time the transcendental goal of nibbana, the cessation of suffering. At this point, he changes his lineage from that of the man in the street to that of the noble ones, the Arya. With the winning of the stream to full enlightenment also arises the unshakable conviction, I shall come to know the unknown. Whatever should happen from now on, his destiny is certain. He cannot avoid becoming enlightened. Eventually, the remaining paths are successfully travelled, and the meditator at last breaks free completely from the treacherous grip and allure of samsara. He or she is free of the dreadful, lingering, self-assumed burden of misery and anguish. He or she becomes arahant, a perfected being, one worthy to receive gifts. He breathes the clean, sweet air of freedom and knows that the task is completed. Never again can he make the mistakes of the past. He's totally free from error, from wrong action, from wrong thought. At last, he is at peace and feels no more need to search.